Welcome to our discussion on The Arms of Krupp. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. So this was a heavy podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and intermingle serious questions with just some, I don't want to say fun thoughts, but just some lighter questions.
Yeah.
I'll start out with some lighter questions that may seem a little bit abstract, but I'm always curious about this. The common thread in stories nowadays that we hear about arms dealers is that they always are faced with some kind of moral question, or they have to develop a moral shield to help them do what they
do.
That's commonplace. So I think of like Lord of War, and that story is like based off of someone who actually is an arms seller or had been in the past. He created this kind of moral shield for himself to say, you know, somebody's got to sell him the gun, so it's going to be me.
Right.
Using the Krupp family as an example, is this depiction accurate, in your opinion, when you've read in history about families like this?
That's a good question. I think it was very individualistic. I think some arms dealers probably did have to. I know more about Alfred, Gustav, and Alfried, kind of the three major figures of the 20th century, than I do about the earlier ones, and they did not have any moral qualms about what they were doing. So there was no necessity for a moral shield. They were steeped in the social Darwinist traditions of Germany in the first half of the 20th century, which said that certain groups of people, certain nations, certain classes are inherently superior, and so by natural selection, they're going to dominate and perhaps remove those lesser elements from civilization. This is not unique to the Nazis. The German militarists of the First World War had the same belief system. They classified the lesser races differently, or the lesser nations. It was not races in Germany under the Kaiser. It was lesser nations. And so Krupp and the other arms manufacturers like Thyssen and others, they had no moral, as I said, qualms about what they were doing.
So it wasn't even just a business to them. It was this, there was some kind of political mindset or societal mindset behind their work.
I don't think that was the motivating factor. I think the motivating factor was a business. Okay. This was just their family industry, had been since the 1500s. But it was they were able to, if they had any moral qualms, they were able to rationalize it based on what their society taught at the time.
Okay. Was there a parallel at all with the advancing military technology that the Krupp family brought with other developing tech that came out, not specifically linked to war, but we found in history when people are developing machines of war and processes of war, other inventions come out of it that help
folks? Yeah, I mean, factories that make guns also make just as easily other like household consumer products and things like that. And that's what Krupp did. At various times when it was not legal or not politic for them to make weapons, they switched over to making trains or trucks or farm equipment and things like that. So yes, you do see a number of innovations. I don't know any off the top of my head, but the period of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, all across the industrialized world, but especially in Germany, was a time of great innovation and new technology and things like that.
Okay.
And I think Krupp was one of the first firms in Europe to follow Henry Ford's example of the assembly line, and that allowed them to churn out products at a much higher quantity at a much lower price.
Mm. You were talking about the fact that the Krupp family obviously held a monopoly.
Pretty close.
Yeah. What was the benefit to Germany throughout the years for aligning themselves with the Krupps as opposed to other families who were maybe creating similar product?
Well, by the point where we get a united Germany in 1871, there really are no other families in Germany. Basically, the only reason it wasn't a total monopoly is the Krupps did not control some of the supplies that were needed for their products. Almost everything in Germany that was needed for their weapons and their products was owned directly by the Krupp family, but they still needed to import certain goods, like, for example, like oil. Germany does not have a whole lot of oil domestically, and so they brought that in. That was what prevented them from being a total monopoly. So as far as the German government was concerned, the Krupps were their natural allies. They're making exactly what made Germany, what defined Germany as a great power, the military. They're making the Krupps are making the equipment and the weapons and the vehicles and everything else that they need in order to advance German military power.
So by the time these world wars happened, as an example, there wasn't really any competition out there.
Not in Germany.
Okay.
there was from like Vickers in Great Britain, and I think it was either Renault or Citroën in France that now make cars that were also producing weapons. I'm pretty sure it was Renault, but Krupp was the best.
Okay.
I mean, objectively speaking, their weapons were the best.
When it came to competition within Germany, did the German government ever purchase weapons from France or from Britain, or was it specifically from the Krupps?
I believe they purchased, before World War I, naval technology from the British.
Okay.
But I could be wrong on that. It's trying to remember the German arms buildup, especially in like the 1880s and 1890s, before Great Britain and Germany started to drift apart after Queen Victoria's death. I'm pretty sure the Germans did buy naval technology from Britain. France, no. The Germans and the French, I mean, Germany was born in a war with France. The French are not going to sell them weapons, and the Germans aren't going to buy weapons from France. Germany did buy tons of weapons from the United States. We sold them all kinds of stuff.
In World War One or Two?
No, before. But okay. No, this is all before World War One. Gotcha. By World War Two, Germany is, I think, exclusively using German-made products.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was curious because you had talked about how they viewed other nations in the world as not as powerful as them.
Mm-hmm.
So if that translated, I didn't know if that went to the product as well.
Yeah, I think in terms of naval technology, Britain was superior to Germany in almost every way. And so they're going to buy from the best.
So they were actually honest about it, saying, well, they're better than us. Let's buy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So wasn't, I think during Hitler's reign, it was like, we're superior regardless versus before that.
Sure.
It was like, it was a little bit different to say, okay, well, this group actually has better tech than we do. All right.
Yeah. So we'll buy from the best.
When they started to produce weapons, what was it about the first means of production, the first processes that made them understand this was going to be extremely profitable?
It was there, and this jumps back in time to the period of Napoleon's rule. The Gustav Fabrik was the first factory that forged crucible steel. And I'm going to do my best to get the terms right. I don't have notes in front of me, but it was a product. It was a metal that was lighter and that was harder than anything else that was produced except in Britain. Britain was the first nation in the world to use crucible steel. And then Krupp stole that technology and became the first continental power to use crucible steel. Mm. And so from there, they're making weapons of a higher quality and at a lower price. And that's what then sparks the continuing investment by Napoleon, by the Prussians, by other countries before the great national rivalries of like the 1850s, 1860s. Everyone's investing in Krupp and everyone is buying from Krupp. And so this investment just accelerates their development of new weapons, new technology, almost to the nth degree.
What was the evolution of Krupp in terms of selling to other countries? At what point did they decide we're exclusively selling to Germany? Or only Germany?
It was after Germany became a united nation. Within 10 years of Germany's creation as a formal empire in 1871, by 1881, they're selling their products exclusively to Germany. Now, they will license designs to other countries.
Okay.
So Vickers, for example, was using German Krupp designs right through the end of the First World War. And it's funny because as I was reading for this, Vickers made it very clear, we're not paying you during World War I for any of this. And so after the war, Krupp sends Vickers and the British government this massive bill for every gun that was used, that was a Krupp design used by the British against the Germans. And the British government like, no, we're not paying it. And Vickers, no, we're not paying it. And so Krupp says, well, fine, we're not going to have anything to do with you anymore. And then it was Vickers bombers that destroyed the Gustav Fabrik and the other factories around Essen in 1942.
Interesting.
So until that point, they would sell to anyone. I mean, going all the way back to the founding of the Krupp family, during the 30 Years' War, they sold weapons to both sides in that long conflict.
And in that case, there was no moral conundrum because, again, it was just whoever wins this is the superior group.
So. Well, actually, there was more of a moral component at that point because that was the last great religious war in Europe.
Okay.
And the Krupps, I'm like 90% sure they were Protestant, and they sold almost exclusively to Protestant powers. They sold to the Habsburgs, who were Catholic because the Habsburgs were the wealthiest family in Europe at the time. But most of their weapons went to Protestants. And that was a moral component, or that was a moral impetus for who they decided to do business with. But that goes away by about the time of the Enlightenment. And now it's just whoever has the biggest pocketbook.
Okay. So going forward a little bit, tell us the story of Big Bertha. Why, what was the unfortunate circumstance by which that howitzer was
Well,
named?
It wasn't an unfortunate circumstance. He wanted that as his, that was a tribute to his wife. It just sounds like he's calling her.
So he called her Big Bertha?
No. He called the gun. That particular model of howitzers had the nickname Big Bertha.
Okay. So was her name Bertha?
Yes, his wife's name was Bertha. She was the last heir of Friedrich Alfred, I believe it was. So when Gustav takes over, he is not a by blood member of the Krupp family. She holds all of the assets, but because Kaiser Wilhelm said, no, we shouldn't have a woman running this massive family and industry, he marries into it, and he wants to honor his wife a decade later when World War I breaks out. And so he names, I think it was the most widely used field artillery piece of the First World War in Germany, that's named after his wife, Big Bertha.
Obviously not too quick on the uptake when it came to understanding artillery after.
All right. I'm going to speculate here for a second because I don't have notes in front of me. In German, Große Bertha has two, the word groß, which is the German word for large, has two translations. It can either mean large physically, or it can mean great, as in like a great leader.
Ah.
Or like Frederick the Great, he was known as Friedrich der Große. So it could have been just a bad translation. I'm willing to guess that it was. Again, I don't have notes in front of me to prove any of that, but I'm pretty sure. I bet it's actually in William Manchester's book, The Arms of Krupp. We're about 10 minutes in and we haven't mentioned that yet. All of you should go read this book. It's fantastic.
Yeah. When you first heard of the book, The Arms of Krupp, what were you assigned to read it, or was it something you heard about?
Yeah, it was something I read in college. It was, I think it was in my German history class, basically from this 30 Years War to unification. We read this and a couple of other books, and immediately I loved it. I think it's a fantastic book, very well written, a little biased at times, because Manchester is very evidently a fan of German culture, but not a fan of German politics, and he intersperses all kinds of like biting commentary about the German political system then and now. Now being a relative term, in 1968 when the book was, I think it was 1968 when the book was published. But it's a great story. I mean, history books, a lot of them can be dull recitations of names, dates, facts, and figures. This is a story, and it's a very well told. It's a little long. And he goes into maybe more detail than a casual reader of history would want. It's over 1,000 pages long, but it's a very, very good picture or viewpoint of German history through the eyes of its most powerful family after the Hohenzollerns.
As a professional historian, how did reading about the Krupp family add dimensions to your understanding of German history and its influence on the world?
I'd have to go back to what I remembered from college. It was really more of it was part of what got me interested in German history, because I started with German language before I got involved in German history. And reading that book and chronicling the rise of this country that is really pretty new. I mean, Germany is, 95 years younger than the United States, and the massive impact that it had on the history of the world from 1871, really, I mean, even on to today, is largely because of that family. Because if you don't have the arms of Krupp, if you don't have the massive influence and the power that they wielded economically tied to German political movements like militarism and later Nazism, you don't have German war making, you don't have, and then all that comes out of that. I mean, the two world wars, as we've talked many times about on this podcast, literally shaped every aspect of our lives today.
Mm-hmm.
We're living in the world that the Krupps helped to bring about.
Yeah, I would say from the Krupp standpoint, I would say the good and the bad, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's also just an interesting, kind of as I went into with learning from history, it's an interesting study of how corporatism and, you know, the alliance between big business and big government is nothing new. You know, we in America right now are seeing an increasing level of coordination between business and government, and that's been going on for at least 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a new phenomenon.
So I was a little confused in the podcast when it came to Gustav, because it sounded like he was horrified by what Germany was doing or Hitler was doing.
And then he became a super Nazi.
Right. And that's my question.
Yeah.
So we both talked on this podcast about a book called Good Men,
mm-hmm.
where the process of Polish officers under the influence of the SS to round up Jews and all that, slowly they went from being good police officers who were honorable men to monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Was the process like this similar Did he start out saying this is wrong, and then over time, as he was more exposed to it, began to accept it and then support it?
Yes. And okay. It was largely because of the finances. German rearmament at that stage, about 15 years after the Treaty of Versailles was signed, German armament is accelerating. The German government is openly defying the Treaty of Versailles, and Gustav wants in on that. Fritz Thyssen and Rudolf Diesel and other firms are getting in on this. They're making money. Krupp doesn't want to be left out in the cold. And from there, once the business relationship between Krupp and the Nazi Party begins, and Krupp starts to fall under Hitler's sway, I mean, every account you read of Adolf Hitler and his speaking ability and his personal magnetism is that he could charm anyone. And Krupp is an example of that. Someone who initially was horrified, as you said, by what the Nazis were doing, within a couple years, is at every rally chanting Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, and collaborating with Germany, and collaborating with the government on rearmament. And then he supports his son when his son joins the SS and commits all kinds of war crimes.
How is it possible to know that someone is advocating and eventually responsible for the mass genocide of people and still be seduced by charm? How is that possible?
Well, I don't have a good answer for it, but I can say that Gustav was not alone. I mean, I think I've mentioned in here, but I know I talk about it with my students. By percentage of people, Germany was the most Christian country in the world based on church attendance in 1933.
But when you say Christian, was that based on theology?
That's based on regular church attendance.
Okay,
more
so just a church.
Per capita, based on, you know, adjusting for population, more Germans were in church regularly every Sunday. Now, were they actually believers? It's not for us to judge hearts and minds.
Right.
My point is, Hitler seduced an entire nation, and he said openly, this is what I'm going to do. So Gustav was not unique among German industrialists, German civilian leaders, German military leaders who heard the words, it is time to remove the Jewish race from our society, and went, okay. Once again, Joe's rage is evident here.
It's just...
Last couple weeks have been rough,
with these topics.
Hopefully you're going to lighten our
our
mood.
I will.
Next week.
I guess my question is, I know that the Nazis corrupted the church in Germany, that they rewrote the Bible, they put new versions of the Bible out. But you're saying, in terms of the timeline, people were looking to this nationalism-type theology, saying... Okay, he's going to bring us back from the brink.
Not a theology, but a nationalist
ideology,
yes. Okay. And remember, Germany is in the midst of the Great Depression, just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler comes to power promising bread and work. That's his slogan. And the German people latch on to that very, very quickly because they don't have bread and they don't have work. They can't feed their families. The government's not doing anything. The government of Heinrich Brüning is raising taxes in the middle of the Depression. He's raising taxes on the poor and cutting them for the rich, for men like Gustav Krupp. The people are like, okay, we've had enough of this, and we will support anyone, any voice who offers change.
Was there a sense from anyone who was in that mindset of supporting whomever came forward that they didn't believe it was going to be as bad what it actually turned out to be?
The accounts of the men and women who eventually joined the anti-Hitler resistance movement, which culminates in the July 20th, 1944 assassination attempt, many of them were early supporters of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. And they, as they learned what was going on in the East and at the concentration camps, as Hitler is launching one war after another and sending millions of German men and boys to their deaths, they realize, okay, we were wrong. We have to stand up and stop this guy.
Okay.
And many of them paid with their lives.
Yeah. I just can't get past that. Sorry. I'm just thinking about how much money is worth a human life? Like, how much is it worth that you would knowingly say, I am not only okay with this, but I am going to support it in order to earn money as people are gassed alive?
I don't know.
I mean, when you and I went to Auschwitz We walked through those buildings that were full of suitcases and wedding rings and human hair that was going to be used to make socks and clothes for German soldiers.
When we walked into the ovens, into the gas chamber at Auschwitz I, did you notice the three-ring symbol on the door?
No.
That's the Krupp logo. It's still there.
Yeah.
And all the documentation is in that Auschwitz museum at Auschwitz I. All of the signatures, all of the papers that bear the signature of Alfried and Gustav.
So how did they get away with that?
After the war, there were a number of factors that led to the general Nazi amnesty that happened in 1950, I believe it was. One was the recognition of the growing tensions with the Soviet Union. We need Nazi researchers, Nazi scientists to get us involved in building nuclear missiles and in the space race. So that's where we get Wernher von Braun and Günther Wendt and other NASA figures who are involved in ultimately getting us to the moon. That's where they came in. We also needed experts to rebuild Germany because, as we've talked about again in the past, Germany is destroyed by the war. We burned down every German city with a population of more than 20,000.
Yeah.
American experts can come in and help, but the people are going to be more willing to accept German firms that are rebuilding, that are taking the lead in the rebuilding process. And so they don't offer a complete amnesty. None of the major war criminals who were tried at Nuremberg were released as part of that general amnesty by McCloy, but some of the lesser Nazis from the other trials were ultimately released because the idea was they must have been just following orders. And that whole just following orders defense is very, very common in the post-war Nazi trials and ultimately the fate of a lot of those people.
So a common argument in favor of like saying, is it really their fault?
Yes. They were just following orders because the way that Germany was organized under the Führerprinzip, the leadership principle, everything was the fault of Hitler and Himmler and Heydrich and Goering and Goebbels and the senior leadership. So those guys who were executed at Nuremberg or who died by their own hands or died during the war, they're all gone. We don't need to continue to punish these people for just following orders. Now, fortunately, that whole idea, which I think is nonsense, has been abandoned. And you still see the Germans and the Israelis working together to prosecute, you know, 100-year-old concentration camp guards and things like that. Just following orders is no longer considered a justification for crimes against humanity. But it was in the 50s. And so Krupp got all of his money back, all of his factories, and lived very handsomely with the blood of 6 million people on his hands.
I want to talk about that. It was an American commissioner, John McCloy, who pardoned him.
Yes, did not acquit him, said, you are still guilty of this, but we're going to let you out of prison.
So did that, and then gave him that controlling interest over Krupp AG.
Yeah.
So does John McCloy, he give justification for both of those actions? Did anybody ask him why he was doing this for a war criminal?
I would imagine, I don't know for sure, and I should have anticipated your question on this, so forgive me for this. I don't want to give bad information as I'm thinking about this. So if it's okay with you, Joe, we'll pause that question and we're going to do an episode at the end of the season where it's kind of a summary of discussion of things that we didn't quite have enough information on or we wanted to clarify, things like that. Is that okay if we postpone that discussion?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
As a reminder,
I try not to do that. I try to answer your questions as best I can, but sometimes I just fall down on the job and don't.
Well, as a reminder, we don't know the questions that are being asked.
Right.
So it's usually a surprise. And the point is to have that spontaneity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I made it 3.5 seasons without having to do this.
Yeah, but we will find out because that's
a huge question.
That's obviously egregious and it's infuriating. Mm-hmm. It's embarrassing. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. I mean,
think the Krupps are still actually getting money from their firm now.
Yeah.
No. Sorry, that stopped when his son Arndt died. I think that's when the payments stopped.
I know that there's a scene in Band of Brothers, and I've read the book as well, where they discover the concentration camp, and they go into the town, and they start to get food from the bakeries, from the stores, to feed these people. And then, you know, the doctors say, hey, don't let them gorge, because they're starving. They're skeletons.
Yep.
And there's a scene where two of the American soldiers are going into the bakery and they're just taking cakes and bread and everything. And the baker's all ticked off.
Oh, yeah.
And he's saying, you know, I'm not a Nazi. I didn't do this. And one of the soldiers pulls his gun on him and points at just like, you are 2 miles from this camp. And I think about that scene right now as we're talking.
Mm-hmm. And that camp, those kinds of camps were all around every one of the factories. That's what they used in the factories at Krupp and everywhere else in Germany.
And maybe that baker didn't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Krupp knew. The Krupp family knew.
Absolutely.
So I would have loved to see them visit their own chambers and experience the horror that they inflicted on other people.
Absolutely. I
agree. That would have been a just punishment and then burn them down afterwards.
The people?
No, the buildings.
Oh. Yeah. Burn their company to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Allies did that pretty effectively in 1942, I believe it was. Yeah, that was the end. And actually, Gustav, he arrived at the Gustavfabrik the day after the bombing raid, and he suffered a paralytic collapse at seeing his life's work and his family's life's work destroyed.
Outstanding.
And that was the end of, he survived until 1950, but he never recovered from that.
I was going to ask you what his illness was.
I believe it was a series of strokes, I'm pretty sure. I know his son Alfred died of lung cancer. And I think Gustav died of complications from a series of strokes.
So, and those were provoked by him seeing his empire
destroyed.
Outstanding.
Wow.
Sorry. I'm not sorry.
No.
This is, I just don't have the words and I don't want to have to mark this podcast as
explicit. Well, we can always beep stuff if we need to.
Explicit. Okay. Taking a step back.
Yes. You promised some lighthearted questions.
Yeah,
too. Maybe,
yes.
Maybe
I don't know about
those.
Lighthearted, lighter, okay. Lighter, not rage filled or fueled. So you, at the end of the podcast, touched on the corporate and government interests like sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a challenging issue. It's the corruption of both the capitalism and a democratic model. Like when we think about governments aligning themselves with corporations. Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer capitalism, it's corporatism.
Right.
The subtitle of this episode is The Dangers of Corporatism. And this is, we're seeing that right now.
So what are some warning signs to look for in our age? You talked about some of them.
Yeah.
And obviously there's not a direct comparison. But I want to go back to the example of the book Good Men. Because it's never, we start at the camps. It's never, ever the camps first. It's always a progression of small things that lead to something that is horrific.
Mm-hmm.
Or could lead there. What are some things that we need to be aware of as consumers, as voters, to help us navigate those warning signs and stop them before it's allowed to progress farther?
It's a really good question. I think, in addition to what I talked about in the episode, one of the biggest warning signs is when you see a revolving door between government and business, where government officials, when they leave, when a term is over or something like that, they immediately go in and they get a big media contract or they get put on a bunch of corporate boards. And then as soon as their party is back in, they immediately go back into government service. I'll give one example from each side. If you have Republicans who are involved in, let's say, the first Bush administration, let's do that. Let's jump back a little bit further. So 1992, George H.W. Bush loses his campaign. A whole bunch of his people in his administration left government service and they went to serve on the boards of oil companies or the boards of major defense contractors and things like that. And then when Bush 43 comes into office, they immediately go back in there. When you start to see that kind of alignment, and the same is true with Democrats, Bill Clinton's administration ends in 2000, a whole bunch of those people go serve in major media or they get involved in tech startups and Silicon Valley. And then when Obama comes into office in 2008, they go right back in. When you see a revolving door between government and business, whether we're talking about big tech or big media or big oil or big finance or big weapons, that's an early warning sign. There should be, my opinion, there should be a very clear conflict between government and business, because the fundamental purpose of government is to regulate and direct the lives of its citizens. You know, we can talk about freedom and liberty and all of that, but government is power. And the more you have, the more you want. Business should want to operate with as few constraints as possible, again, consistent with good order and things like that. So when you have big business aligning with big government, there's a reason for that. because they want a share of the power that government has over the citizens. The businesses want to get some of that. They want to get some of that money. They want to get some of that power, some of that influence. They want to carve out exceptions for themselves. See the, you know, pre-2011 situation on Wall Street. Say what you want about Elizabeth Warren. I happen to disagree with a lot of her policies, but her financial reforms that she was able to get through when she was elected to the Senate were very, very necessary because it reined in the power of Wall Street to screw up our lives. They still have way too much of it, but it was far worse beforehand. And they got that by carving out exemptions that applied only to big businesses, but did not apply to all businesses. I'm a free market guy. I don't want, you know, any kind of corporatism, socialism, anything like that. But there has to be a level playing field. And government should exist to create that level playing field so that Google, they can go as far as they can, and so can a mom and pop shop. Amazon, they can go as far as they can, so can Borders. Borders Bookstore was destroyed by Amazon because Amazon got a whole bunch of tax breaks.
They still get tax breaks. Yeah, they still get mail packages.
Oh, yeah. The point is, watch for those revolving doors and watch for the aligning of government and big business against small business and consumers.
Would you say the role of government in this circumstance is to enforce the field being the same for companies both large and small, or is it their protection of the rights of businesses to be large or small?
It's both.
Okay, because if it's an enforcement, it's the government dictating that over a company one way or the other.
But the dictation is, you know, making sure that you can't create a monopoly, making sure that you can't squeeze out. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about government limiting growth, except in the interests of a free and open market.
Right.
That's where government's role in the economy, I think, should be.
Okay. How do we hold government and private, quote unquote, institutions
in check? Private business. They can do what they want. Yeah. That's tough because in our current political climate, the mainstream of both political parties is perfectly in line with this corporate ideology. The left, they love the fact that social media is censoring people. And the right loves the fact that Wall Street is making money hand over fist without any kind of oversight or regulation or anything like that.
I would say there's some on the left and some on the right, right?
The mainstream. Yeah. The mainstream left and the mainstream right. One of the reasons why we got the populist insurgency of Donald Trump is because people on both the left and the right said, we're tired of this. We still don't have firm numbers because so much of our data collection in terms of political campaigns has been corrupted. But there are plenty of examples of Bernie Sanders leftists voting for Donald Trump in 2016. Not talking about the most recent election. There was a whole lot of other stuff going on there. I'm talking about in 2016, people saying, listen, Bernie was our guy because he stood up to the establishment, left and right. With him out of the race, thank you, Hillary and the DNC, we're going to support the other insurgent candidate, the other populist who's saying, no, government exists, yes, to level playing fields, but fundamentally, government exists to protect the people. And if big business is starting to infringe on the rights of the people to live their lives, to speak the way they want to, we need to get involved and we need to start to regulate that. We need to start to push back against that. So to answer your question, it's about one, informing ourselves, which is really tough when Google controls 90% of search engines. It's about gathering as much information as humanly possible about what is going on in our world. And then it's about supporting candidates. If this is an issue that appeals to you, not based on party affiliation, but based on what they say about the issue of corporatism, about the issue of big business and big government working together. I happen to think that it's one of the defining issues of our time because you now have companies on Wall Street, short sellers, who can destroy a company with a few words on CNBC and a few tweets. The Reddit guys who are saving GameStop, that was a reaction against that. At the same time, you have big tech literally silencing a former president of the United States while he was in office. After January 6th, saying, all right, you're done talking to the American people. And they have continued to follow those kinds of policies. Now, this is not a statement in support of Donald Trump or anyone on his side. This is a recognition that big tech and the power that they have and are wielding against people who they disagree with, that's dangerous. Same thing with like pop culture, media, entertainment, this whole issue of cancel culture. When they're destroying people's lives for having political opinions that they happen to disagree with, that is incredibly dangerous. And it's something that needs to be addressed. It's going to be a long process. We are talking about companies that have more money than like probably 4/5 of the countries on Earth, who have tremendous political power, who have tremendous economic power, and who are aligned with countries around the world who hate us, who despise our values. I'll call out Disney because I hate everything about that company. They fire a woman because she tweeted something they dislike, while at the same time actively supporting, engaging with, and funding a political party in a country that has concentration camps no different than what the Nazis had. And Disney makes movies there. They change characters and marketing strategies to support that country's racist ideas. They thank the leaders of these concentration camps in their credits.
Yeah.
And yet they're a wonderful corporate, you know, woke culture and all of that. I get very, very angry and very passionate when I talk about exactly how much I hate Disney, specifically. So if this is an issue you care about, look to history, learn the lessons. No, Disney is not like Krupp. No, Disney is not actually building the concentration camps in that country. But as you said, in Good Men, it doesn't start with the camps. It starts with an alignment, a series of small steps that can, not will, can lead down a very dangerous path. And it is up to us, because we still have the right to vote, to inform ourselves, to care about these issues, and ultimately to put a stop to this.
If our audience wants to learn more about this topic, what can they do to accomplish that?
About the Arms of Krupp?
Yeah.
Read the book, The Arms of Krupp. There are some other great books about German history in this period. I would recommend Iron Kingdom, which is about the origins of Germany as a national state. And that also takes us through the First World War. And then the best book on Nazi Germany, well, not the best, but a really, really good one, is William Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And I would recommend that one to our audience.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of The Arms of Krupp. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and see you all next week.